Disc 3. Grosvenor Square was quietness itself. There were traces of broken glass still on the pavements. There were even eggs, squashed tomatoes, and fragments of gleaming metal. But above, the stars were peaceful. Car after car drove up to the embassy door to collect the home-going guests. The police were there in the corners of the square, but without ostentation. Everything was under control. One of the political guests, leaving, spoke to one of the police officers. He came back and murmured, "Not too many arrests. 8. They'll be up at Bow Street in the morning. More or less the usual lot. Petronella was here, of course, and Stephen and his crowd. Oh, well. One would think they'd get tired of it one of these days."
"You live not very far from here, don't you?"
said a voice in Sir Stafford Nye's ear, a deep contralto voice. "I can drop you on my way."
No, I can walk perfectly. It's only 10 minutes or so."
"It will be no trouble to me, I assure you," said the Countess Zakovsky. She added, "I'm staying at the St. James's Tower."
The St. James's Tower was one of the newer hotels.
"You're very kind."
It was a big, expensive-looking hire car that waited. The chauffeur opened the door. The Countess Renata got in, and Sir Stafford Nye followed her. It was she who gave Sir Stafford Nye's address to the chauffeur. The car drove off.
"So, you know where I live," he said.
"Why not?"
He wondered just what that answer meant.
Why not?
"Why not indeed," he said. "You know so much, don't you?" He added, "It was kind of you to return my passport. I thought it might save certain inconveniences. It might be simpler if you burnt it. You've been issued with a new one, I presume?"
"You presume correctly."
"Your bandit's cloak you will find in the bottom drawer of your tall boy. It was put there tonight. I believe that perhaps to purchase another one would not satisfy you, and indeed that to find one similar might not be possible."
"It'll mean more to me now that it has been through certain adventures," said Stafford Nye. He added, "It has served its purpose."
The car purred through the night. The Countess Zakovsky said,
"Yes, it has served its purpose, since I am here, alive."
Sir Stafford Nye said nothing. He was assuming, rightly or not, that she wanted him to ask questions, to press her, to know more of what she had been doing, of what fate she had escaped. She wanted him to display curiosity. But Sir Stafford Nye was not going to display curiosity. He rather enjoyed not doing so. He heard her laugh very gently, yet he fancied, rather surprisingly, that it was a pleased laugh, a laugh of satisfaction, not of stalemate.
"Did you enjoy your evening?" she said.
"A good party, I think. But Millie Jean always gives good parties."
"You know her well, then?"
"I knew her when she was a girl in New York before she married. A pocket Venus."
She looked at him in faint surprise.
"Is that your term for her?"
"Actually, no. It was said to me by an elderly relative of mine."
"Yes. It isn't a description that one hears given often of a woman nowadays. It fits her, I think, very well, only..."
"Only what?"
"Venus is seductive, is she not?
Is she also ambitious?"
"You think Millie Jean Courtman is ambitious?"
"Oh, yes. That above all."
"And you think to be the wife of the ambassador to St. James's is insufficient to satisfy ambition?"
"Oh, no," said the Countess. "That is only the beginning."
He did not answer. He was looking out through the car window. He began to speak, then stopped himself. He noted her quick glance at him, but she too was silent. It was not till they were going over a bridge with the Thames below them that he said,
"So, you are not giving me a lift home, and you are not going back to the St. James's Tower. We're crossing the Thames. We met there once before, crossing a bridge. Where are you taking me?"
"Do you mind?"
"I think I do."
"Yes, I can see you might."
"Well, of course, you are quite in the mode. Hijacking is the fashion nowadays, isn't it?" "You've hijacked me. Why?"
"Because, like once before, I have need of you," she added, "and others have need of you."
"Indeed. And that does not please you?"
"It would please me better to be asked." If I had asked, would you have come?
Perhaps yes, perhaps no.
I am sorry.
I wonder.
They drove on through the night in silence. It was not a drive through lonely country. They were on a main road. Now and then the lights picked up a name or a signpost so that Stafford and I saw quite clearly where their route lay, through Surrey and through the first residential portions of Sussex. Occasionally he thought they took a detour or a side road, which was not the most direct route, but even of this he could not be sure. He almost asked his companion whether this was being done because they might possibly have been followed from London. But he had determined rather firmly on his policy of silence. It was for her to speak, for her to give information. He found her, even with the additional information he had been able to get, an enigmatic character. They were driving to the country after a dinner party in London. They were, he was pretty sure, in one of the more expensive types of hire car. There was something planned beforehand. Reasonable. Nothing doubtful or unexpected about it. Soon, he imagined, he would find out where it was they were going, unless, that is, they were going to drive as far as the coast. That also was possible, he thought. Haslemere, he saw on a signpost. Now they were skirting Godalming. All very plain and above board. The rich countryside of moneyed suburbia. Agreeable woods, handsome residences. They took a few side turns, and then as the car finally slowed, they seemed to be arriving at their destination. Gates. A small white lodge by the gates. Up a drive. Well-kept rhododendrons on either side of it. They turned round a bend and drew up before a house. "Stockbroker Tudor," murmured Sir Stafford Nye, under his breath. His companion turned her head inquiringly. "Oh, just a comment," said Stafford Nye. "Pay no attention. I take it we are now arriving at the destination of your choice. And you don't admire the look of it very much." "Well, the grounds seem well kept," said Sir Stafford, following the beam of the headlights as the car rounded the bend. "Takes money to keep these places up and in good order. I should say this was a comfortable house to live in." "Comfortable, but not beautiful. The man who lives in it prefers comfort to beauty, I should say." "Perhaps wisely," said Sir Stafford. "And yet in some ways he is very appreciative of beauty, of some kinds of beauty." They drew up before the well-lighted porch. Sir Stafford got out and tendered an arm to help his companion. The chauffeur had mounted the steps and pressed the bell. He looked inquiringly at the woman as she ascended the steps.
"You won't be requiring me again tonight, milady?"
"No, that's all for now. We'll telephone down in the morning."
"Good night."
"Good night, sir."
There were footsteps inside, and the door was flung open. Sir Stafford had expected some kind of butler, but instead there was a tall grenadier of a parlour-maid, grey-haired, tight-lipped, eminently reliable and competent, he thought. An invaluable asset, and hard to find nowadays. Trustworthy. Capable of being fierce.
"I am afraid we are a little late," said Renata. "The master is in the library. He asked that you and the gentleman should come to him when you had arrived."
Chapter 9. The House Near Godalming. She led the way up the broad staircase, and the two of them followed her. "Yes," thought Stafford Nye. "A very comfortable house. Jacobean paper. A most unsightly carved oak staircase, but pleasantly shallow treads. Pictures, nicely chosen, but of no particular artistic interest. A rich man's house," he thought. "A man not of bad taste, a man of conventional tastes. Good thick-pile carpet, of an agreeable plum-coloured texture." On the first floor, the grenadier-like parlour-maid went to the first door along it. She opened it and stood back to let them go in, but she made no announcement of names. The Countess went in first, and Sir Stafford Nye followed her. He heard the door shut quietly behind him. There were four people in the room. Sitting behind a large desk which was well covered with papers, documents, an open map or two, and presumably other papers which were in the course of discussion, was a large, fat man with a very yellow face. It was a face Sir Stafford Nye had seen before, though he could not for the moment attach the proper name to it. It was a man whom he had met only in a casual fashion, and yet the occasion had been an important one. He should know. Yes, definitely, he should know, but why wouldn't the name come? With a slight struggle,
The figure sitting across the desk rose to his feet. He took the Countess Renata's outstretched hand.
"You've arrived," he said.
"Splendid!"
"Yes. Let me introduce you, though I think you already know him. Sir Stafford Nye, Mr. Robinson."
"Of course." In Sir Stafford Nye's brain, something clicked like a camera. That fitted in, too, with another name, Pikeaway. To say that he knew all about Mr. Robinson was not true. He knew about Mr. Robinson all that Mr. Robinson permitted to be known. His name, as far as anyone knew, was Robinson, though it might have been any name of foreign origin. No one had ever suggested anything of that kind. Recognition came also of his personal appearance. The high forehead, the melancholy dark eyes, the large, generous mouth, and the impressive white teeth. False teeth, presumably. But at any rate, teeth of which it might have been said, like in Red Riding Hood, "The better to eat you with, child." He knew, too, what Mr. Robinson stood for. Just one simple word described it. Mr. Robinson represented money, with a capital M. Money, in its every aspect. International money. Worldwide money. Private home finances. Banking. Money not in the way the average person looked at it. You never thought of him as a very rich man. Undoubtedly, he was a very rich man, but that wasn't the important thing. He was one of the arrangers of money, the great clan of bankers. His personal tastes might even have been simple, but Sir Stafford Nye doubted if they were. A reasonable standard of comfort, even luxury, would be Mr. Robinson's way of life, but not more than that. So behind all this mysterious business, there was the power of money.
"I heard of you just a day or two ago," said Mr. Robinson as he shook hands, "from our friend Pikeaway, you know?"
That fitted in, thought Stafford Nye, because now he remembered that on the solitary occasion before that he had met Mr. Robinson, Colonel Pikeaway had been present. Horsham, he remembered, had spoken of Mr. Robinson. So now, there was Mary Ann, or the Countess Tsiolkovsky, and Colonel Pikeaway sitting in his own smoke-filled room, with his eyes half-closed, either going to sleep or just waking up, and there was Mr. Robinson, with his large yellow face. And so there was money at stake somewhere. And his glance shifted to the three other people in the room, because he wanted to see if he knew who they were, and what they represented, or if he could guess. In two cases, at least, he didn't need to guess. The man who sat in the tall porter's chair by the fireplace, an elderly figure framed by the chair as a picture frame might have framed him, was a face that had been well known all over England. Indeed, it still was well known, although it was very seldom seen nowadays. A sick man, an invalid, a man who made very brief appearances, and then it was said at physical cost to himself in pain and difficulty. Lord Altamont. A thin, emaciated face, outstanding nose, grey hair which receded just a little from the forehead and then flowed back in a thick, grey mane, somewhat prominent ears that cartoonists had used in their time, and a deep, piercing glance that not so much observed as probed. Probed deeply into what it was looking at. At the moment, it was looking at Sir Stafford Nye. He stretched out a hand as Stafford Nye went towards him.
"I don't get up," said Lord Altamont. His voice was faint, an old man's voice, a faraway voice. "My back doesn't allow me. Just come back from Malaya, haven't you, Stafford Nye?"
"Yes."
"Was it worth your going? I expect you think it wasn't." "You're probably right, too. Still, we have to have these excrescences in life, these ornamental trimmings to adorn the better kind of diplomatic lies. I'm glad you could come here. Or were brought here tonight. Mary Ann's doing, I suppose."
"So that's what he calls her, and thinks of her as," thought Stafford Nye to himself. It was what Horsham had called her. She was in with them then, without a doubt. As for Altamont, he stood for... well, what did he stand for nowadays? Stafford Nye thought to himself, "He stands for England. He still stands for England until he's buried in Westminster Abbey or a country mausoleum, whatever he chooses. He has been England, and he knows England. And I should say he knows the value of every politician and government official in England pretty well, even if he's never spoken to them." Lord Altamont said.
This is our colleague, Sir James Cleek.
Stafford and I didn't know Cleek. He didn't think he'd even heard of him. A restless, fidgety type. Sharp, suspicious glances that never rested anywhere for long. He had the contained eagerness of a sporting dog, awaiting the word of command, ready to start off at a glance from his master's eye. But who was his master? Altamont? Or Robinson? Stafford's eye went round to the fourth man. He had risen to his feet from the chair where he'd been sitting close to the door. Bushy moustache, raised eyebrows, watchful, withdrawn, managing in some way to remain familiar, yet almost unrecognizable.
"So it's you," said Sir Stafford Nye. "How are you, Horsham?"
"Very pleased to see you here, Sir Stafford."
"Quite a representative gathering," Stafford Nye thought, with a swift glance round. They had set a chair for Renata not far from the fire, and Lord Altamont. She had stretched out a hand, her left hand, he noticed, and he had taken it between his two hands, holding it for a minute, then dropping it. He said,
"You took risks, child. You take too many risks."
Looking at him, she said,
"It was you who taught me that, and it's the only way of life."
Lord Altamont turned his head towards Sir Stafford Nye.
"It wasn't I who taught you to choose your man. You've got a natural genius for that."
Looking at Stafford Nye, he said,
"I know your great-aunt. Or your great-great-aunt, is she?"
"Great-aunt Matilda," said Stafford Nye immediately.
"Yes, that's the one. One of the Victorian tour de force of the 90s. She must be nearly 90 herself now."
He went on,
"I don't see her very often. Once or twice a year, perhaps. But it strikes me every time, that sheer vitality of hers that outlives her bodily strength. They have the secret of that, those indomitable Victorians, and some of the Edwardians as well."
Sir James Cleek said, "Let me get you a drink, Nye. What will you have?
Gin and tonic, if I may."
The Countess refused with a small shake of the head. James Cleek brought Nye his drink and set it on the table near Mr. Robinson. Stafford Nye was not going to speak first. The dark eyes behind the desk lost their melancholy for a moment. They had quite suddenly a twinkle in them.
"Any questions?" he said.
"Too many," said Sir Stafford Nye.
"Wouldn't it be better to have explanations first, questions later?"
"Is that what you'd like?"
"It might simplify matters."
"Well, we start with a few plain statements of facts. You may or you may not have been asked to come here. If not, that fact may rankle slightly."
"He prefers to be asked always," said the Countess. "He said as much to me."
"Naturally," said Mr. Robinson.
"I was hijacked," said Stafford Nye. "Very fashionable, I know. One of our more modern methods."
He kept his tone, one of light amusement.
"Which invites, surely, a question from you," said Mr. Robinson. "Just one small word of three letters. Why?"
"Quite so. Why?"
"I admire your economy of speech. This is a private committee. A committee of inquiry. An inquiry of worldwide significance."
"Sounds interesting," said Sir Stafford Nye.
"It is more than interesting. It is poignant and immediate. Four different ways of life are represented in this room tonight," said Altamont. "We represent different branches. I have retired from active participation in the affairs of this country, but I am still a consulting authority. I have been consulted and asked to preside over this particular inquiry as to what is going on in the world in this particular year of our Lord, because something is going on. James here has his own special task. He is my right-hand man. He is also our spokesman. Explain the general set-out, if you will, Jamie, to Sir Stafford here."
It seemed to Stafford Nye that the gun-dog quivered. "At last, I can speak and get on with it," He leaned forward a little in his chair. "If things happen in the world, you have to look for a cause for them. The outward signs are always easy to see, but they're not, or so the chairman," he bowed to Lord Altamount, "and Mr. Robinson and Mr. Horsham believe, important. It's always been the same way. You take a natural force, a great fall of water that will give you turbine power. You take the discovery of uranium from pitchblende, and that will give you in due course nuclear power that had not been dreamt of or known. When you found coal and minerals, they gave you transport, power, energy. There are forces at work always that give you certain things, but behind each of them there is someone who controls it. You've got to find who's controlling the powers that are slowly gaining ascendancy in practically every country in Europe. Further afield, still in parts of Asia. Less, possibly, in Africa, but again, in the American continents, both north and south. You've got to get behind the things that are happening and find out the motive force that's making them happen. One thing that makes them happen is money." He nodded towards Mr. Robinson. "Mr. Robinson here knows as much about money as anybody in the world, I suppose."
"It's quite simple," said Mr. Robinson. "There are big movements afoot. There has to be money behind them. We've got to find out where that money's coming from. Who's operating with it? Where do they get it from? Where are they sending it to? Why? It's quite true what James says. I know a lot about money, as much as any man alive knows today. Then there are what you might call trends. It's a word we use a good deal nowadays. Trends or tendencies. There are innumerable words one uses. They mean not quite the same thing, but they're in relationship with each other. A tendency, shall we say, to rebellion shows up. Look back through history. You'll find it coming again and again, repeating itself like a periodic table, repeating a pattern. A desire for rebellion, the means of rebellion, the form the rebellion takes. It's not a thing particular to any particular country. If it arises in one country, it will arise in other countries, in less or more degrees. That's what you mean, sir, isn't it?" He half turned towards Lord Altamont. "That's the way you more or less put it to me."
"Yes, you're expressing things very well." "James?"
"It's a pattern that arises and seems inevitable. You can recognize it where you find it. There was a period when a yearning towards crusades swept countries. All over Europe, people embarked in ships. They went off to deliver the Holy Land. All quite clear, a perfectly good pattern of determined behavior. But why did they go? That's the interest of history, you know. Seeing why these desires and patterns arise. It's not always a materialistic answer, either. All sorts of things can cause rebellion. A desire for freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of religious worship. Again, a series of closely related patterns. It led people to embrace emigration to other countries, to formation of new religions, very often as full of tyranny as the forms of religion they had left behind. But in all this, if you look hard enough, if you make enough investigations, you can see what started the onset of these and many other, I'll use the same word, patterns. In some ways it's like a virus disease. The virus can be carried round the world, across seas, up mountains. It can go and infect. It goes, apparently, without being set in motion. But one can't be sure, even now, that that was always really true. There could have been causes, causes that made things happen. One can go a few steps further. There are people, one person, 10 persons, a few 100 persons, who are capable of being and setting in motion a cause. So it is not the end process that one has to look at. It's the first people who set the cause in motion. You have your crusaders, you have your religious enthusiasts, you have your desires for liberty, you have all the other patterns, but you've got to go further back still. Further back to a hinterland. Visions, dreams. The prophet Joel knew it when he wrote, "Your old men shall dream dreams, your young men shall see visions." And of those two, which are the more powerful? Dreams are not destructive, but visions can open new worlds to you, and visions can also destroy the worlds that already exist. James Cleek turned suddenly towards Lord Altamont. "I don't know if it connects up, sir," he said, "but you told me a story once of somebody in the embassy at Berlin, a woman."
"Oh, that. Yes, I found it interesting at the time. Yes, it has a bearing on what we're talking about now. One of the embassy wives. Clever, intelligent woman, well-educated. She was very anxious to go personally
and hear the Führer speak. I'm talking, of course, of a time immediately preceding the 1939 war. She was curious to know what oratory could do. Why was everyone so impressed? And so she went. She came back and said, "It's extraordinary. I wouldn't have believed it. Of course, I don't understand German very well, but I was carried away, too. And I see now why everyone is. I mean, his ideas were wonderful. They inflamed you. The things he said, I mean. You just felt there was no other way of thinking, that a whole new world would happen if only one followed him. Though I can't explain properly. I'm going to write down as much as I can remember, and then, if I bring it to you to see, you'll see better than my just trying to tell you the effect it had. I told her that it was a very good idea. She came to me the next day, and she said, 'I don't know if you'll believe this.' I started to write down the things I'd heard, the things Hitler had said, what they'd meant. But it was frightening. There wasn't anything to write down at all. I didn't seem to be able to remember a single stimulating or exciting sentence. I have some of the words, but it doesn't seem to mean the same thing as when I wrote them down. They're just meaningless. I don't understand.' That shows you one of the great dangers one doesn't always remember, but it exists. There are people capable of communicating to others a wild enthusiasm, a kind of vision of life and of happening. They can do that, though it is not really by what they say. It is not the words you hear, it is not even the idea described, it is something else. It is the magnetic power that a very few men have of starting something, of producing and creating a vision, by their personal magnetism, perhaps, a tone of voice, perhaps some emanation that comes forth straight from the flesh, I don't know. But it exists. Such people have power. The great religious teachers had this power, and so has an evil spirit power also. Belief can be created in a certain movement, in certain things to be done, things that will result in a new heaven and a new earth, and people will believe it and work for it and fight for it and even die for it." He lowered his voice as he said, "Jan Smuts puts it in a phrase. He said, 'Leadership, besides being a great creative force, can be diabolical.'" Stafford Nye moved in his chair. "I understand what you mean. It is interesting what you say. I can see, perhaps, that it might be true. But you think it's exaggerated, of course." "I don't know that I do," said Stafford Nye. "Things that sound exaggerated are very often not exaggerated at all. They are only things you haven't heard said before or thought about before, and therefore they come to you as so unfamiliar that you can hardly do anything about them except accept them. By the way, may I ask a simple question? What does one do about them? If you come across the suspicion that this sort of thing is going on, you must find out about them," said Lord Altamont. "You've got to go like Kipling's mongoose. Go and find out. Find out where the money comes from, and where the ideas are coming from, and where, if I may say so, the machinery comes from. Who is directing the machinery? There's a chief of staff, you know, as well as a commander-in-chief. That's what we're trying to do. We'd like you to come and help us." It was one of the rare occasions in his life when Sir Stafford Nye was taken aback. Whatever he may have felt on some former occasions, he had always managed to conceal the fact. But this time, it was different. He looked from one to the other of the men in the room, at Mr. Robinson, impassive, yellow-faced, with his mouthful of teeth displayed, to Sir James Cleek, a somewhat brash talker, Sir Stafford Nye had considered him, but nevertheless he had obviously his uses. Master's dog, he called him in his own mind. He looked at Lord Altamont, the hood of the porter's chair framed round his head. The lighting was not strong in the room. It gave him the look of a saint in a niche in a cathedral somewhere. Ascetic. 14th century. A great man. Yes, Altamont had been one of the great men of the past,
Stafford Nye had no doubt of that. But he was now a very old man. Hence, he supposed, the necessity for Sir James Cleek and Lord Altamont's reliance on him. He looked past them to the enigmatic, cool creature who had brought him here, the Countess Renata Zakowski, alias Mary Ann, alias Daphne Theodophanus. Her face told him nothing. She was not even looking at him. His eyes came round at last to Mr. Henry Horsham, of Security. With faint surprise, he observed that Henry Horsham was grinning at him. "But look here," said Stafford Nye, dropping all formal language and speaking rather like the schoolboy of 18 he had once been. "Where on earth do I come in? What do I know? Quite frankly, I'm not distinguished in any way in my own profession, you know. They don't think very much of me at the F.O. Never have."
"We know that," said Lord Altamont.
It was Sir James Cleek's turn to grin, and he did so.
"All the better, perhaps," he remarked, and added apologetically as Lord Altamont frowned at him, "Sorry, sir."
"This is a committee of investigation," said Mr. Robinson. "It is not a question of what you have done in the past, of what other people's opinion of you may be. What we are doing is to recruit a committee to investigate. There are not very many of us at the moment forming this committee. We ask you to join us, because we think that you have certain qualities which may help in an investigation."
Stafford Nye turned his head towards the security man.
"What about it, Horsham?" he said. "I can't believe you'd agree with that."
"Why not?" said Henry Horsham.
"Indeed. What are my qualities, as you call them? I can't quite frankly believe in them myself."
"You're not a hero worshipper," said Horsham. "That's why. You're the kind who sees through humbug. You don't take anyone at their own or the world's valuation. You take them at your own valuation."
"Ce n'est pas un garçon sérieux," the words floated through Sir Stafford Nye's mind,
a curious reason for which to be chosen for a difficult and exacting job.
"I've got to warn you," he said, "that my principal fault, and one that's been frequently noticed about me and which has cost me several good jobs, is, I think, fairly well known. I'm not, I should say, a sufficiently serious sort of chap for an important job like this."
"Believe it or not," said Mr. Horsham, "that's one of the reasons why they want you."
"I'm right, my lord, aren't I?"
He looked towards Lord Altamont.
"Public service," said Lord Altamont. "Let me tell you that very often one of the most serious disadvantages in public life is when people in a public position take themselves too seriously. We feel that you won't."
"Anyway," he said, "Mary Ann thinks so."
Sir Stafford Nye turned his head. So here she was, no longer a countess. She had become Mary Ann again.
"You don't mind my asking," he said, "but who are you, really? I mean, are you a real countess?"
"Absolutely. Geboren, as the Germans say. My father was a man of pedigree, a good sportsman, a splendid shot, and had a very romantic but somewhat dilapidated castle in Bavaria. It's still there, the castle. As far as that goes, I have connections with that large portion of the European world which is still heavily snobbish as far as birth is concerned. A poor and shabby countess sits down first at the table, whilst a rich American with a fabulous fortune in dollars in the bank is kept waiting.
What about Daphne Theodophanus? Where does she come in?"
"A useful name for a passport.
My mother was Greek."
"And Mary Ann?"
It was almost the first smile Stafford Nye had seen on her face. Her eyes went to Lord Altamont, and from him to Mr. Robinson.
"Perhaps," she said, "because I am a kind of maid of all work, going places, looking for things, taking things from one country to another, sweeping under the mat, do anything, go anywhere, clear up the mess."
She looked towards Lord Altamont again.
"Am I right, Uncle Ned?"
"Quite right, my dear. Mary Ann, you are, and always will be, to us."
"Were you taking something on that plane? I mean, taking something important from one country to another?"
"Yes. It was known I was carrying it. If you hadn't come to my rescue, if you hadn't drunk, possibly, poisoned beer, and handed over your bandit cloak of bright colours as a disguise, well, accidents happen sometimes."
I shouldn't have got here. What were you carrying? Or mustn't I ask? Are there things I shall never know?
There are a lot of things you will never know. There are a lot of things you won't be allowed to ask.
I think that question of yours I shall answer. A bare answer of fact, if I am allowed to do so.
Again she looked at Lord Altamont.
I trust your judgment, said Lord Altamont.
Go ahead.
Give him the dope, said the irreverent James Cleek.
Mr. Horsham said,
I suppose you've got to know. I wouldn't tell you, but then I'm security.
Go ahead, Marianne.
One sentence. I was bringing in a birth certificate, that's all. I don't tell you any more, and it won't be any use your asking any more questions.
Stafford and I looked round the assembly.
All right. I'll join. I'm flattered at your asking me. Where do we go from here?
You and I, said Renata, leave here tomorrow. We go to the continent. You may have read or know that there is a musical festival taking place in Bavaria. It is something quite new which has only come into being in the last 2 years. It has a rather formidable German name, meaning the Company of Youthful Singers, and is supported by the governments of several different countries. It is in opposition to the traditional festivals and productions of Bayreuth. Much of the music given is modern. New young composers are given the chance of their compositions being heard. Whilst thought of highly by some, it is utterly repudiated and held in contempt by others.
Yes, said Sir Stafford, I've read about it. Are we going to attend it?
We have seats booked for two of the performances.
Has this festival any special significance in our investigation?
No, said Renata. It is more in the nature of what you might call an exit and entry convenience. We go there for an ostensible and true reason, and we leave it for our next step in due course.
He looked round. Instructions? Do I get any marching orders? Am I to be briefed?
Not in your meaning of those terms. You are going on a voyage of exploration. You will learn things as you go along. You will go as yourself, knowing only what you know at present. You go as a lover of music, as a slightly disappointed diplomat who has perhaps hoped for some post in his own country which he has not been given. Otherwise, you will know nothing. It is safer so.
But that is the sum of activities at present. Germany, Bavaria, Austria, the Tyrol, that part of the world.
It is one of the centres of interest.
It is not the only one.
Indeed, not even the principal one. There are other spots on the globe, all of varying importance and interest. How much importance each one holds is what we have to find out.
And I don't know, or am not to be told anything about these other centres.
Only in cursory fashion. One of them, we think, the most important one, has its headquarters in South America. There are two with headquarters in the United States of America, one in California, the other in Baltimore. There is one in Sweden, there is one in Italy. Things have become very active in the latter in the past 6 months. Portugal and Spain also have smaller centres, Paris, of course. There are further interesting spots just coming into production, as you might say, as yet not fully developed.
You mean Malaya? Or Vietnam?
No. No, all that lies rather in the past. It was a good rallying cry for violence, and student indignation, and for many other things. What is being promoted, you must understand, is the growing organization of youth everywhere, against their mode of government, against their parental customs, against, very often, the religions in which they have been brought up. There is the insidious cult of permissiveness. There is the increasing cult of violence. Violence not as a means of gaining money, but violence for the love of violence. That particularly is stressed, and the reasons for it are to the people concerned one of the most important things and of the utmost significance.
Permissiveness? Is that important?
It is a way of life, no more.
It lends itself to certain abuses, but not unduly.
What about drugs?
The cult of drugs has been deliberately advanced and fermented. Vast sums of money have been made that way, but it is not, or so we think, entirely activated for the money motive.
All of them looked at Mr. Robinson, who slowly shook his head.
No, he said. It looks that way,
There are people who are being apprehended and brought to justice. Pushers of drugs will be followed up. But there is more than just the drug racket behind all this. The drug racket is a means, and an evil means, of making money. But there is more to it than that. But who? Stafford Nye stopped. Who, and what, and why, and where? The four W's. That is your mission, Sir Stafford, said Mr. Robinson. That's what you've got to find out, you and Marianne. It won't be easy. And one of the hardest things in the world, remember, is to keep one's secrets. Stafford Nye looked with interest at the fat, yellow face of Mr. Robinson. Perhaps the secret of Mr. Robinson's domination in the financial world was just that. His secret was that he kept his secret. Mr. Robinson's mouth showed its smile again. The large teeth gleamed. If you know a thing, he said, it is always a great temptation to show that you know it, to talk about it, in other words. It is not that you want to give information. It is not that you have been offered payment to give information. It is that you want to show how important you are. Yes, it's just as simple as that. In fact, said Mr. Robinson, and he half closed his eyes, everything in this world is so very, very simple. That's what people don't understand. The Countess got to her feet, and Stafford Nye followed her example. I hope you will sleep well and be comfortable, said Mr. Robinson. This house is, I think, moderately comfortable. Stafford Nye murmured that he was quite sure of that, and on that point he was shortly to be proved to have been quite right. He laid his head on the pillow and went to sleep immediately. Book 2. Journey to Siegfried. Chapter 10. The Woman in the Schloss. They came out of the Festival Youth Theatre to the refreshing night air. Below them, in a sweep of the ground, was a lighted restaurant. On the side of the hill was another, smaller one. The restaurants varied slightly in price, though neither of them was inexpensive. Renato was in evening dress of black velvet. Sir Stafford Nye was in white tie and full evening dress. A very distinguished audience, murmured Stafford Nye to his companion. Plenty of money there. A young audience, on the whole. You wouldn't think they could afford it. Oh, that can be seen to. It is seen to. A subsidy for the elite of youth, that kind of thing. Yes. They walked towards the restaurant on the high side of the hill. They give you an hour for the meal, is that right? Technically an hour. Actually, an hour and a quarter. That audience, said Sir Stafford Nye. Most of them, nearly all of them, I should say, are real lovers of music. Most of them, yes. It is important, you know. What do you mean, important? That the enthusiasm should be genuine. At both ends of the scale, she added. What do you mean exactly by that? Those who practice and organize violence must love violence, must want it, must yearn for it. The seal of ecstasy in every movement, of slashing, hurting, destroying, and the same thing with the music. The ears must appreciate every moment of the harmonies and beauties. There can be no pretending in this game. Can you double the roles? Do you mean you can combine violence and a love of music or a love of art? It is not always easy, I think, but yes. There are many who can. It is safer, really, if they do not have to combine roles. It's better to keep it simple, as our fat friend Mr. Robinson would say. Let the lovers of music love music, let the violent practitioners love violence. Is that what you mean? I think so. I'm enjoying this very much. The 2 days that we have stayed here, the 2 nights of music that we have enjoyed, I have not enjoyed all the music, because I am not perhaps sufficiently modern in my taste. I find the clothes very interesting. Are you talking of the stage production? No, I was talking of the audience, really. You and I, the squares, the old-fashioned. You, Countess, in your society gown. I in my white tie and tails. Not a comfortable get-up, it never has been. And then the others, the silks and the velvets, the ruffled shirts of the men. Real lace, I noticed, several times. And the plush and the hair and the luxury of avant-garde.
the luxury of the 1800s, or you might almost say of the Elizabethan age, or of Van Dyck pictures.
Yes, you are right.
I know nearer, though, to what it all means. I haven't learnt anything. I haven't found out anything.
You mustn't be impatient.
This is a rich show, supported, asked for, demanded perhaps by youth, and provided by...
By whom?
We don't know yet.
We shall know.
I'm so glad you're sure of it. They went into the restaurant and sat down. The food was good, though not in any way ornate or luxurious. Once or twice they were spoken to by an acquaintance or a friend. Two people who recognized Sir Stafford Nye expressed pleasure and surprise at seeing him. Renata had a bigger circle of acquaintances, since she knew more foreigners. Well-dressed women, a man or two, mostly German or Austrian, Stafford Nye thought, one or two Americans. Just a few desultory words, where people had come from or were going to, criticism or appreciation of the musical fare. Nobody wasted much time, since the interval for eating had not been very long. They returned to their seats for the two final musical offerings, a symphonic poem, Disintegration in Joy, by a new young composer, Solyukhinov, and then the solemn grandeur of the March of the Meistersingers. They came out again into the night. The car, which was at their disposal every day, was waiting there to take them back to the small but exclusive hotel in the village street. Stafford Nye said good night to Renata. She spoke to him in a lowered voice.
4 a.m., she said. Be ready.
She went straight into her room and shut the door, and he went into his. The faint scrape of fingers on his door came precisely at 3 minutes to 4 the next morning. He opened the door and stood ready.
The car is waiting, she said. Come.
They lunched at a small mountain inn. The weather was good, the mountains beautiful. Occasionally, Stafford Nye wondered what on earth he was doing here. He understood less and less of his travelling companion. She spoke little. He found himself watching her profile. Where was she taking him? What was her real reason? At last, as the sun was almost setting, he said, "Where are we going? Can I ask?"
"You can ask, yes."
"But you do not reply."
"I could reply. I could tell you things. But would they mean anything?
It seems to me that if you come to where we are going without my preparing you with explanations, which cannot in the nature of things mean anything, your first impressions will have more force and significance." He looked at her again, thoughtfully. She was wearing a tweed coat trimmed with fur, smart travelling clothes, foreign in make and cut. "Marianne," he said thoughtfully. There was a faint question in it.
"No," she said. "Not at the moment."
"Ah, you are still the Countess Zirkovsky."
"At the moment, I am still the Countess Zirkovsky."
"Are you in your own part of the world?"
"More or less. I grew up as a child in this part of the world. For a good portion of each year, we used to come here in the autumn to a schloss not very many miles from here."
He smiled and said thoughtfully, "What a nice word it is, a schloss. So solid-sounding. Schlosser are not standing very solidly nowadays. They are mostly disintegrated." "This is Hitler's country, isn't it? We're not far, are we, from Berchtesgaden?"
"It lies over there to the northeast."
"Did your relations, your friends, did they accept Hitler?
Believe in him?
Perhaps I ought not to ask things like that."
"They disliked him and all he stood for.
But they said, Heil Hitler. They acquiesced in what had happened to their country.
What else could they do?
What else could anybody do at that date?" "We're going towards the Dolomites, are we not?"
"Does it matter where we are, or which way we are going?"
"Well, this is a voyage of exploration, is it not?"
"Yes, but the exploration is not geographical. We are going to see a personality."
"You make me feel..." Stafford Nye looked up at the landscape of swelling mountains reaching up to the sky, "as though we were going to visit the famous old man of the mountain.
The master of the assassins, you mean, who kept his followers under drugs so that they died for him wholeheartedly, so that they killed, knowing that they themselves would also be killed, but believing too that that would transfer them immediately to the Muslim paradise. Beautiful women, hashish and erotic dreams, perfect
and unending happiness. She paused a minute and then said, "Spellbinders. I suppose they have always been there throughout the ages. People who make you believe in them so that you are ready to die for them. Not only assassins. The Christians died also. The holy martyrs. Lord Altamont? Why do you say Lord Altamont? I saw him that way, suddenly, that evening. Carved in stone, in a 13th-century cathedral, perhaps. One of us may have to die. Perhaps more." She stopped what he was about to say. "There is another thing I think of sometimes. A verse in the New Testament, Luke, I think. Christ at the Last Supper, saying to his followers, 'You are my companions and my friends, yet one of you is a devil.' So in all probability, one of us is a devil." "You think it possible?" "Almost certain. Someone we trust and know, but who goes to sleep at night not dreaming of martyrdom, but of 30 pieces of silver, and who wakes with the feeling of them in the palm of his hand. The love of money, ambition covers it better. How does one recognize a devil? How would one know? A devil would stand out in a crowd, would be exciting, would advertise himself, would exercise leadership." She was silent a moment, and then said in a thoughtful voice, "I had a friend once in the diplomatic service who told me how she had said to a German woman how moved she herself had been at the performance of the Passion Play at Oberammergau. But the German woman said scornfully, 'You do not understand. We Germans have no need of a Jesus Christ. We have our Adolf Hitler here with us. He is greater than any Jesus that ever lived.' She was quite a nice, ordinary woman, but that is how she felt. Masses of people felt it. Hitler was a spellbinder. He spoke, and he listened, and accepted the sadism, the gas chambers, the tortures of the Gestapo." She shrugged her shoulders and then said in her normal voice, "All the same, it's odd that you should have said what you did just now." "What was that?" "About the old man of the mountain, the head of the assassins. Are you telling me there is an old man of the mountain here?" "No, not an old man of the mountain, but there might be an old woman of the mountain." "An old woman of the mountain? What's she like?" "You'll see her this evening." "And what are we doing this evening?" "Going into society," said Renata. "It seems a long time since you've been Mary Ann." "You'll have to wait till we are doing some air travel again." "I suppose it's very bad for one's morale," Stafford Nye said thoughtfully, "living high up in the world." "Are you talking socially?" "No, geographically. If you live in a castle on a mountain peak overlooking the world below you, well, it makes you despise the ordinary folk, doesn't it? You're the top one, you're the grand one. That's what Hitler felt in Berchtesgaden. That's what many people feel, perhaps, who climb mountains and look down on their fellow creatures in valleys below."
"You must be careful tonight," Renata warned him. "It's going to be ticklish."
"Any instructions?"
"You're a disgruntled man. You're the one that's against the establishment, against the conventional world. You are a rebel, but a secret rebel. Can you do it?"
"Well, I can try." The scenery had grown wilder. The big car twisted and turned up the roads, passing through mountain villages, sometimes looking down on a bewilderingly distant view where lights shone on a river, where the steeples of churches showed in the distance. "Where are we going, Mary Ann?"
"To an eagle's nest."
The road took a final turn. It wound through a forest. Stafford Nye thought he caught glimpses now and again of deer or of animals of some kind. Occasionally, too, there were leather-jacketed men with guns. Keepers, he thought. And then they came finally to a view of an enormous schloss standing on a crag. Some of it, he thought, was partially ruined, though most of it had been restored and rebuilt. It was both massive and magnificent. But there was nothing new about it, or in the message it held. It was representative of past power, power held through bygone ages. This was originally the Grand Duchy of Liechtenstutz. The schloss was built by the Grand Duke Ludwig in 1790, said Renata.
Who lives there now?
The present Grand Duke? No. They are all gone and done with. Swept away. And who lives here now, then? Someone who has present-day power, said Renata. Money? Yes, very much so. Shall we meet Mr. Robinson, flown on ahead by air to greet us? The last person you'll meet here will be Mr. Robinson, I can assure you. A pity, said Stafford Nye. I like Mr. Robinson. He's quite something, isn't he? Who is he really? What nationality is he? I don't think anybody has ever known. Everyone tells one something different. Some people say he is a Turk. Some that he's an Armenian. Some that he's Dutch. Some that he's just plain English. Some say that his mother was a Circassian slave, a Russian Grand Duchess, an Indian Begum, and so on. Nobody knows. One person told me that his mother was a Miss McClellan from Scotland. I think that's as likely as anything. They had drawn up beneath a large portico. Two men-servants in livery came down the steps. Their bows were ostentatious as they welcomed the guests. The luggage was removed. They had a good deal of luggage with them. Stafford Nye had wondered to begin with why he had been told to bring so much, but he was beginning to understand now that from time to time there was need for it. There would, he thought, be need for it this evening. A few questioning remarks, and his companion told him that this was so. They met before dinner, summoned by the sound of a great resounding gong. As he paused in the hall, he waited for her to join him, coming down the stairs. She was in full, elaborate evening dress tonight, wearing a dark red velvet gown, rubies round her neck, and a ruby tiara on her head. A manservant stepped forward and conducted them. Flinging open the door, he announced, "The Gräfin Zirkowski, Sir Stafford Nye." "Here we come, and I hope we look the part," said Sir Stafford Nye to himself. He looked down in a satisfied manner at the sapphire and diamond studs in the front of his shirt. A moment later he had drawn his breath in an astonished gasp. Whatever he had expected to see, it had not been this. It was an enormous room, rococo in style, chairs and sofas and hangings of the finest brocades and velvets. On the walls there were pictures that he could not recognize all at once, but where he noted, almost immediately, for he was fond of pictures, what was certainly a Cézanne, a Matisse, possibly a Renoir, pictures of inestimable value. Sitting on a vast chair, throne-like in its suggestion, was an enormous woman. A whale of a woman, Stafford Nye thought. There was really no other word to describe her. A great, big, cheesy-looking woman, wallowing in fat, double, treble, almost quadruple chins. She wore a dress of stiff orange satin. On her head was an elaborate crown-like tiara of precious stones. Her hands, which rested on the brocaded arms of her seat, were also enormous. Great big fat hands with great big fat shapeless fingers. On each finger, he noticed, was a solitaire ring. And in each ring, he thought, was a genuine solitaire stone. A ruby, an emerald, a sapphire, a diamond, a pale green stone which he did not know, a chrysoprase, perhaps, a yellow stone which, if not a topaz, was a yellow diamond. She was horrible, he thought. She wallowed in her fat. A great, white, creased, slobbering mass of fat was her face, and set in it, rather like currants in a vast currant bun, were two small black eyes. Very shrewd eyes, looking on the world, appraising it, appraising him, not appraising Renata, he thought. Renata, she knew. Renata was here by command, by appointment. However you liked to put it, Renata had been told to bring him here. He wondered why. He couldn't really think why, but he was quite sure of it. It was at him she was looking. She was appraising him, summing him up. Was he what she wanted? Was he, yes, he'd rather put it this way, was he what the customer had ordered? I'll have to make quite sure that I don't know what it is she does want, he thought. I'll have to do my best, otherwise, he could quite imagine that she might raise a fat, ringed hand and say to one of the tall, muscular footmen, "Take him and throw him over the battlements." It's ridiculous, thought Stafford Nye. Such things can't happen nowadays. Where am I?
What kind of a parade, a masquerade, or a theatrical performance am I taking part in?
You have come very punctual to time, child.
It was a hoarse, asthmatic voice, which at once had an undertone he thought of strength, possibly even of beauty. That was over now. Renata came forward, made a slight curtsy. She picked up the fat hand and dropped a courtesy kiss upon it.
Let me present to you Sir Stafford Nye, the Gräfin Charlotte von Waldsassen.
The fat hand was extended towards him. He bent over it in the foreign style. Then she said something that surprised him.
I know your great aunt, she said.
He looked astounded, and he saw immediately that she was amused by that, but he saw, too, that she had expected him to be surprised by it. She laughed, a rather queer, grating laugh, not attractive.
Shall we say, I used to know her. It is many, many years since I have seen her. We were in Switzerland together, at Lausanne, as girls. Matilda, Lady Matilda Baldenwhite.
What a wonderful piece of news to take home with me, said Stafford Nye.
She is older than I am. She is in good health?
For her age, in very good health. She lives in the country, quietly. She has arthritis, rheumatism.
Ah, yes, all the ills of old age. She should have injections of procaine. That is what the doctors do here, in this altitude. It is very satisfactory. Does she know that you are visiting me?
I imagine that she has not the least idea of it, said Sir Stafford Nye. She knew only that I was going to this festival of modern music.
Which you enjoyed, I hope?
Oh, enormously. It is a fine festival opera hall, is it not?
One of the finest. Pah! It makes the old Bayreuth festival hall look like a comprehensive school. Do you know what it cost to build, that opera house?
She mentioned a sum in millions of marks. It quite took Stafford Nye's breath away, but he was under no necessity to conceal that. She was pleased with the effect it made upon him.
With money, she said, if one knows, if one has the ability, if one has the discrimination, what is there that money cannot do? It can give one the best.
She said the last two words with a rich enjoyment, a kind of smacking of the lips which he found both unpleasant and at the same time slightly sinister. I see that here, he said, as he looked round the walls.
You are fond of art? Yes, I see you are. There, on the east wall, is the finest Cézanne in the world today. Some say that the... I forgot the name of it at the moment. The one in the Metropolitan in New York is finer. That is not true. The best Matisse, the best Cézanne, the best of all... That great school of art are here, here in my mountain eyrie.
It is wonderful, said Sir Stafford, quite wonderful. Drinks were being handed round. The old woman of the mountain, Sir Stafford Nye noticed, did not drink anything. It was possible, he thought, that she feared to take any risks over her blood pressure with that vast weight.
And where did you meet this child?
Asked the mountainous dragon. Was it a trap? He did not know, but he made his decision. At the American Embassy in London.
Ah, yes, so I heard. And how is, I forget her name now. Ah, yes, Millie Jean, our southern heiress. Attractive, did you think?
Most charming. She has a great success in London.
And poor, dull Sam Cortman. The United States Ambassador?
A very sound man, I'm sure, said Stafford Nye politely. She chuckled.
You're tactful, are you not? Ah, well, he does well enough. He does what he is told, as a good politician should. And it is enjoyable to be ambassador in London. She could do that for him, Millie Jean. Ah, she could get him an embassy anywhere in the world, with that well-stuffed purse of hers. Her father owns half the oil in Texas. He owns land, gold fields, everything. A coarse, singularly ugly man. But what does she look like? A gentle little aristocrat. Not blatant, not rich. That is very clever of her, is it not?
Sometimes it presents no difficulties, said Sir Stafford Nye.
And you? You are not rich?
I wish I was.
The Foreign Office nowadays, it is not, shall we say, very rewarding?
Well, I would not put it like that. After all, one goes places, one meets amusing people, one sees the world, one sees something of what goes on.
Something, yes, but not everything.
That would be very difficult.
Have you ever wished to see what, how shall I put it, what goes on behind the scenes in life?
One has an idea, sometimes. He made his voice noncommittal.
I have heard it said that that is true of you, that you have sometimes ideas about things, not perhaps the conventional ideas.
There have been times when I've been made to feel the bad boy of the family, said Stafford Nye, and laughed. Old Charlotte chuckled.
You don't mind admitting things now and again, do you?
Why pretend? People always know what you're concealing. She looked at him.
What do you want out of life, young man?
He shrugged his shoulders. Here again he had to play things by ear. Nothing, he said.
Come now. Am I to believe that?
Yes, you can believe it. I'm not ambitious. Do I look ambitious?
No, I will admit that.
I ask only to be amused, to live comfortably, to eat, to drink in moderation, to have friends who amuse me. The old woman leant forward. Her eyes snapped open and shut three or four times. Then she spoke in a rather different voice. It was like a whistling note.
Can you hate? Are you capable of hating?
To hate is a waste of time.
I see. There are no lines of discontent in your face. That is true enough. All the same, I think you are ready to take a certain path which will lead you to a certain place, and you will go along it smiling, as though you did not care. But all the same, in the end, if you find the right advisers, the right helpers, you might attain what you want if you are capable of wanting.
As to that, said Stafford Nye, who isn't? He shook his head at her very gently. You see too much, he said. Much too much. Footman threw open a door. Dinner is served.
End of disc 3.